American Public Media.
This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. What made Einstein, Einstein? How did a clerk in a Swiss patent office go on to develop a series of theories that would revolutionize physics? That's the subject of the book topping the New York Times bestsellers list, Walter Isaacson's Einstein, His Life and Universe. Isaacson spoke about the subject of his book recently at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley, California, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Walter Isaacson is the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan public policy think tank with offices in Washington, D.C. and Aspen, Colorado. Isaacson is the former chairman and CEO of CNN, and before that was managing editor of Time magazine. He has also written popular biographies of Benjamin Franklin and Henry Kissinger. Walter Isaacson's talk last month was sponsored by the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear then, Walter Isaacson speaking in Silicon Valley on April 25th.
I thought I would talk for just a few minutes, and because I'm in Silicon Valley, talk about creativity and imagination as it relates to Albert Einstein. Because Einstein always said that imagination is more important than knowledge. And the more I read about Einstein and studied him, beginning in the early 1990s when we were trying to make him person of the century, we were trying to figure out who's going to be person of the century, I realized that it wasn't his intelligence or his smarts, per se, that made him who he is. In this valley, you know something that's true anywhere, which is that smart people are a dime a dozen. What really counts is creative people. People think out of the box, think different, are able to do things. And that's what Einstein was able to do. The good news for us parents is that Einstein was no Einstein when he was a kid. He was very slow in learning how to talk. The family maid calls him the dopey one. They consult a doctor because they're worried about his verbal ability. He's also very rebellious, causing one headmaster to kick him out of school, another to amuse us by saying this Einstein will never amount to much. But I think it was that slow verbal learning ability and that rebelliousness that are the roots of part of his imagination and creativity. First of all, the slow verbal ability causes him, he says, to think in pictures. He's always able to visualize things. He's able to sense the underlying, think in thought pictures and thought experiments, he called them. It's what you and I would call daydreaming when we're not Einstein. But for him, it was like when his dad gave him a compass at age 5. He spent nights on end trying to picture the force fields in the universe that would cause the needle to twitch. Now, you and I probably remember when we were kids getting a compass, and we go, oh, wow, oh, cool, it points north. And like 3 minutes later, we're on to something else. Einstein marveled, probably because of the slow learning, he said, at the ordinary things. Things like compasses, just like Newton would marvel at the fall of an apple. Things that you and I might sort of take for granted and think completely ordinary. And Einstein once said, the reason I probably discovered relativity where other smarter scientists didn't is because I was so slow in thinking about things like time. And other people had grown up, they thought time, well, it doesn't matter, it just passes along. But I was always mystified by the concept of the movement of time. One thing that's not true about Einstein, unfortunately, is that he flunked math as a kid. You kind of hope that's going to be true. You Google Einstein failed math, and you get about 66,000 websites in which people say, as everybody knows, Einstein flunked math as a kid, so there's probably hope for me or something. Not only did he not flunk math, he thought of math visually. He realized that mathematical equations are simply the good Lord's brushstroke for painting the wonders of reality. I was helping my daughter Betsy, who Bonnie knows quite well, with her homework last week in algebra, and she had gotten an equation wrong. And I said, look, it's x equals 2y squared plus 36 plus this, and you've multiplied. It's got to swoop upward real fast. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, when you look at an equation, you're supposed to visualize it. You're supposed to see which way it goes, how it turns, how it curves. just like, you know, she's doing Latin. I said, just like when you're doing the Odyssey and you see the phrase rosy fingered dawn, you picture it. And she said, oh, they don't teach us that in math. Well, Einstein, being somewhat smarter than my daughter at age 16, when he's 16, he's looking at Maxwell's equations, those wonderful set of equations that describe a light wave in the late 1800s. James Clerk Maxwell had come up with them. And he said, Einstein did, I kept trying to picture the wave and what it would be like to ride alongside the light wave, trying to imagine that, trying to imagine catching up with the light wave. Would it be stationary next to me? He said, you'd think so, but Maxwell's equations say the wave always travels, no matter what your frame of reference, at a constant speed, 186,000 miles per second. So I went around, Einstein said, in a state of anxiety, with my palms sweating, worrying about this dilemma of Maxwell's equations that I was trying to visualize. Now, I can remember quite well the various things causing my palms to sweat when I was 16, and Maxwell's equations weren't any of them. But that's why he's Einstein, and we're not. Anyway, as a rebel, like Ben Franklin, he runs away as a teenager, runs away from the rigid rote learning that he found in Germany at the time, runs away to Italy and then to Switzerland, tries to get into the second best college in Zurich. Which is probably not as good as even the second best college in Palo Alto, one would guess. But it's a Zurich Polytech, and he doesn't get in. He flunks the entrance exam. Not in math, but in languages. He finally gets in on his second try. But due to that impertinent, unconventional way of thinking and his rebelliousness, he's able to tick off all three major professors at the Zurich Polytech. Heinrich Weber, the physics professor, doesn't even teach Maxwell's equations because he finds them kind of too newfangled and stuff. So Einstein starts calling him Herr Weber instead of Herr Professor. And Weber gets annoyed and quits talking to Einstein. And Pernay, who's the laboratory instructor, Einstein was never very good at experiments, which is why he had to become a theorist. But he goes into the lab, crumples up the lab instructions one day, tries it his own way, and blows up the equipment. So Pernay puts him on academic probation. And Minkowski, the math professor there, Einstein doesn't really believe math is all that important to what he's doing. He's incorrect about that. But he has his friend Marcel Grossman take notes for him. So Minkowski, on the report, calls Einstein a lazy dog. Anyway, none of these professors were willing to give him recommendations, which is why he's the only graduate in 1900 of the Zurich Polytech who can't get a job. Can't get a job as a teaching assistant, teaching fellow, anything. Wanders around for a couple years trying to find work. Can't even get a job teaching in high schools. He applies to 17 of them. Finally, Marcel Grossman, the friend who had taken notes from him in math class, pulls some family strings and gets Einstein a job as a third-class examiner in the Swiss patent office in Bern. Third class because Einstein didn't have a doctorate. They had rejected his dissertation twice. So he had to be a third-class examiner, couldn't be a second or first-class examiner. But lest we feel sorry for him, I do think that being in the Bern patent office is probably a little bit like being somewhere in Silicon Valley in the sense of causing you to think inventively and creatively. He is inundated with patent applications, and he's supposed to do thought experiments to figure out the underlying realities of them. And his main field in the patent office, working there 6 days a week on a stool, is looking at technical devices, electrical magnetic devices. And Switzerland had just gone on standard time zone. And the Swiss, being Swiss, were rather obsessive about synchronizing their clocks. When it struck 7 in Zurich, they wanted to strike 7 at that exact moment in Bern. You know, they're Swiss. So there's 70 different patent applications between 1902 and 1905 of people who have come up with all sorts of gizmos to synchronize clocks. And they all have one thing in common. They send a signal between the two clocks. And those signals have something in common, whether it's a radio signal or a light signal or electric signal or whatever, they travel at the speed of light. So there's Einstein still trying to be imaginative, figuring out that Maxwell's equations thing, and thinking about the synchronizing of clocks through light waves and stuff. Now, he's got a friend named Conrad Habeck who fortunately leaves town in early May of 1905. So we have the greatest letter in the history of science, which Albert Einstein is writing to Conrad in a typical Einstein way, totally berating him for being for not sending Einstein his dissertation. And so he addresses Conrad as, "You frozen whale, you canned, smoked piece of soul. I'm going to write you this letter of inconsequential babble because you haven't sent me your dissertation. But if you do, I will send you four papers in return." It's only in the second paragraph that you realize, oh, it's not inconsequential babble. That in his spare time, while working at the patent office, Einstein's been working on some papers, four papers. He says, "The first deals with the properties of energy and light and is very revolutionary." Well, yeah, it is very revolutionary. That's the one that says light's not just a wave, it's a particle, it's a quanta, it's the basis of quantum theory. He goes on to say to Habeck, "The second paper determines the true size of atoms and molecules." Even though most professors at the time weren't sure atoms and molecules existed, Einstein realizes this is the simplest of his papers, so he uses it as his latest attempt to get a doctoral dissertation accepted. The third, he says, deals with Brownian motion, which is why little particles jiggle in water. And he says, and the fourth is only a rough draft in this point, but it involves a modification of the theory of space and time. So you go, oh, wow. That's not inconsequential babble. What he doesn't tell Conrad, because he hadn't thought of it by the time he finished the letter, is as soon as he finishes that fourth paper, another idea will pop into his mind. So he writes an addendum to the fourth paper, a three-page addendum, in which he says, if this is right, then a relationship exists between energy and mass that involves the speed of light and can be done in this formula, E equals mc squared, this equation, most famous equation in all of physics. Helping him with those papers was a brooding, melancholy Serbian woman, student, who had overcome most of the obstacles facing women trying to get into physics. Her father, being an army officer, had gotten her into the Zagreb Academy, which didn't take girls. She had studied physics, finally become a physics student, the only woman physics student in Einstein's class at the Zurich Polytech. And, of course, as you may suspect by the fact that I've raised her name, she falls madly in love with Einstein. Einstein falls madly in love with her. The passionate letters, especially some of the ones that have been under seal until last year that I based this book on, are so vibrant that with a young child in the room, I can't repeat them all. But they're in the book about burning pillows and flaming desire and stuff like that. They take a hike around Lake Como as students. She gets pregnant. They have an illegitimate daughter who's lost to history a bit. I speculate about what happened to Einstein's daughter in the book. Finally, when he gets a job in the patent office, they get to get married. They have two sons, but their relationship totally falls apart. Bitter, bitter fighting. The kids are used as pawns. It's a true disaster. He finally says to her, "One of these days, one of these papers will win the Nobel Prize. If you give me a divorce, I will give you the money from the Nobel Prize." Now, she's a pretty good scientist. She calculates the odds. She thinks about it for a while. Finally takes the bet, and it's not until 1922 that they announce his Nobel Prize. But when they do, she gets the money and buys three apartment buildings in Zurich. Most of you have some familiarity with science, so you pretty much know what relativity is and what his theories are. All I'm going to do is show you how he did it, and this is the point of my lecture, visually and imaginatively. This was not some nerd, doing scientific equations. This is a guy who's just thinking in thought experiments. Relativity, the principle of relativity, is a very simple concept. Galileo knew it all along. Galileo talks about it in the Discourse on Two World Systems, which is if you're in the hold of a ship and all the windows are blacked out, and you're moving at a steady pace, everything you do in the hold of the ship, releasing butterflies, dropping pebbles in water, talking, pouring things, will happen just as if you're on land, at rest. That there's no way to make a distinction between something in motion and what you might call at rest. You may think you're at rest now, and you look outside, see an airplane gliding above, but you're not at rest. You're traveling right now at 36,000 miles per hour around the sun, and the sun's traveling even faster around the galaxy. All motion is relative, and somebody in the airplane can look down, and she can pour a cup of coffee, bounce a ball. All the laws of physics apply in her frame of reference as they do in yours, and she can say she's at rest and the earth is spinning beneath her or something. But that conflicts, and I go into it in the book, I won't now, with the constancy of the speed of light. That 16-year-old kid's thought experiment about why does Maxwell's equation say light always goes at a constant speed. He says, well, I can't resolve that tension. He's all worried about it. He talks to his other friend, Michele Besser, who works with him in the patent office. He says, I've given up. I can't resolve it because it seems that the principle of relativity conflicts with the constancy of the speed of light. It would seem if you're racing away from a light beam, you know, it would move slower in comparison to you. If you're racing towards the source, it would move faster. But Maxwell's equations say no. And then they're walking on a very sunny day in Bern, walking as they always do, he and Michele Besser, as they walk to work or whatever. And he looks at the clock tower in a distant town. They've been trying to synchronize the clocks. The trains outside of their office run right under the famous old 11th century Bern clock tower and run right into the station. So he's seeing the moving trains, and he does a thought experiment, and he says, I've got it. I've got it. And he doesn't explain it to Michele until the next day. He comes into the office and says, here it is. What we call simultaneous is relative. Besso, he has to explain it to Besso. Einstein says, what do we mean when we say something is simultaneous? This is a patent officer talking. He says, we need an operational definition. It means something happens way over there and something happens way over there. A person standing halfway in between will see the light from both of the events at the exact same time. Then he says, imagine lightning striking at the both ends of a fast-moving train. Let's say there's a guy halfway in between the two lightning strikes on the platform. The light, say, hits him at the exact same time. He says, those strikes are simultaneous. Somebody in the moving train, a woman in the moving train, moving forward real fast. By the time the light from the lightning strikes gets to her, it'll take in a fraction of a nanosecond. She will be slightly ahead. This is all a thought experiment. You can't really do it on a real train. And she'll say, the one in front happened first. It happened just slightly first. And Einstein says, that means, since you can't say she's wrong, he's right, because there's no person absolutely at rest, absolutely in motion, all motion is relative, he says, that simply means that different people in different states of motion will have a different definition of what's simultaneous. In other words, simultaneity is relative, depending on your state of motion. And then he goes on, when he writes a paper, beautiful little, you know, simple thing, saying, what do I mean by the passage of time? It just means that when I look at my watch or a clock, the light from that clock strikes me as I'm watching something happen in the real world. So even the passage of time is relative, depending on your state of motion, because it all depends on being simultaneous. So that explains his thought experiment, he realizes as he writes the paper. Try as you may to catch up with a light wave. You'll travel close to the speed of light. Perhaps try to catch up to the speed of light. The light wave will still travel just as fast, but time will slow down for you, so compared to somebody in a different state of motion.
Walter Isaacson, the author of Einstein, His Life and Universe. He was speaking recently in Silicon Valley, California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Now, you're probably shaking your heads a little bit, or some of you know this quite well, and you get it intuitively. It takes a little bit of a while to get it, but as I mentioned, this guy doesn't win the Nobel Prize for 17 years after that. So even the best physicists in all of Europe are thinking, is this wacky philosophy, or is this real physics? In the meantime, after he does all this, as I say, his marriage breaks up, he finally gets a job in Berlin. World War I is in the midst of tearing the place apart. He's falling in love with his own cousin, who's helping him get bread and other things during the food shortages in Berlin in World War I. And he's trying to do the most elegant theory in all of science. And this will be the last theory I'll do, but my point, at least in this lecture here today, is to talk about visualization and imagination as being so key. He realizes that he's already overthrown two of the most important tenets of Sir Isaac Newton, which is that space is absolute and time is absolute. As Newton says in the second book of the Principia, time marches on step by step, second by second, irrespective of our observations of it. And Einstein, of course, says, no, that's not the way it works. Time is relative, depending on your motion. But he's got a problem with the final leg of Newton's universe, which is the theory of gravity. Newton says gravity is just the attraction of two objects at a distance, instantly. And Einstein says, well, nothing can travel instantly over a distance. Nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And he says he's worried that his own theory of relativity, which is called the special theory, only deals with a special case, which is constant velocity motion. What happens with accelerated motion? You know you're in motion. It's different. So he wants, at the same time, to come up with a theory of gravity and a theory that ties accelerated motion into all of his theories. And once again, he does it with a thought experiment. He says, imagine being in an enclosed chamber. Picture like an elevator chamber with all the windows, but no windows. You're in an elevator chamber. And say that elevator chamber is right on the surface of the Earth. What do you feel? You're in a gravitational field. So you feel your feet being pressed to the floor. You take something out of your pocket and you drop it. It falls to the floor at an accelerated rate. Then Einstein says, what would it be like to be in that closed chamber way deep in outer space where there's no gravitational field, but you're accelerating upward? What would you feel? You'd feel your feet being pressed to the floor. You take something out of your pocket and let it go, it would fall to the floor at an accelerated rate. Everything you did would feel the same. And Einstein calls this his principle of equivalence. Gravity is equivalent to acceleration. Now, once again, Newton should have known this. Galileo should have known it. Everybody. We learned it in high school physics. Gravitational mass is always equal to inertial mass, which means the amount of force you got to apply to something in order to get it to accelerate is always equal to the mass that causes it to have weight in a gravitational field. But nobody knew why. Nobody figured out the underlying theory of why are these things always equal until Einstein came along and says it's because acceleration and gravity are equivalent. So people go, huh? You know, what does that mean? And he says it means really simply that gravity is a curving of space. And he does that one more time with a thought picture for us. He says, imagine a two-dimensional fabric. For example, a trampoline fabric. You roll a bowling ball on it, it curves the fabric. You roll some billiard balls behind it, what happens? They roll towards the bowling ball. Why? Not because, as Newton would have it, the bowling ball exerts some spooky, mysterious force at a distance, but because it's curved the fabric of the trampoline, and the balls roll down until they get to the bowling ball. The billiard balls roll down the curve. Now, you and I can easily picture that in two dimensions. A trampoline fabric. If you're Einstein, you can picture it in three dimensions. He says an object actually curves all three dimensions of space. And if you're really Einstein, you can imagine it in four dimensions, because what he really says is space and time are connected, so an object actually curves all four dimensions of space-time. Once again, this totally confuses, or generally confuses, much of the establishment. In fact, it causes a rise of anti-Semitism. Or it's connected to the rise of anti-Semitism that's happening in Germany. It doesn't cause it. Einstein is labeled Jewish science as opposed to Deutsch physics, you know, German physics, because it's all sort of ethereal and not related to reality. And a young politician in Munich, Hitler, starts denouncing Einstein as the type of Jewish science we don't need to be teaching our kids. So Einstein says, I'll have a real experiment where you can test it out. He says, if I'm right that energy has mass, the curvature of space, that sort of thing, it means that gravity will bend a ray of light. Gravity will bend a light beam. And he even calculates for them how it works. He'll say, a distant star or any star, light coming from a starlight, as it passes right next to the sun, the gravity of the sun will bend that light beam 1.7 arc seconds. Well, the problem is you can't look at the stars right behind the sun because the sun gets in your eyes. But right at the end of World War I, a British pacifist Quaker decides to see if he can prove the theory of a German pacifist Jew as a way to overcome all the prejudices in Europe that were reflected in World War I. And he decides to photograph the stars during a total eclipse of the sun to see if they're deflected. Sends an expedition down to Principe in the coast of Africa and another into Brazil, photograph the eclipse during the 3 minutes the sun is in total eclipse. They get about 12 pictures. in both places. They bring him back to London, compare the plates, and then they call a grand meeting of the Royal Academy, in which Sir Arthur Eddington, the astronomer, the Quaker, points to the picture of the first president of the Royal Academy and says, "Forgive us, Sir Isaac Newton, your universe has been overturned." The New York Times back then was back when they knew how to write great headlines. The headline was, and it's in the book, I actually reprint the page of the New York Times in the fame chapter. It says, "Lights all askew in the heavens." It's a six-deck headline. Then it says, "Men of science more or less agog over the eclipse observation. Einstein theory triumphs." And then it says, "Stars not where they appeared or were calculated to be." And then it says, "But nobody need worry." Anyway, he becomes a super celebrity. I'm going to wrap it up here because I think I've given a sense of the thought experiments. He becomes a great super celebrity. He devotes himself to the various political and personal causes, including raising money, coming to the United States to raise money for Hebrew University, refugee Jewish scholars, comes to Caltech, works with Robert Millikan, finally immigrates to the United States and renounces his pacifism when Hitler takes power, writes a famous letter to Franklin Roosevelt saying that a chain reaction could lead to the construction of bombs, thus starting the Manhattan Project, is always a fighter for both free speech, racial justice, free thought and free minds against McCarthyism, and for the last half of his career, instead of being the rebel and being very imaginative, and this is the note of caution I kind of end with, it won't happen to you probably, but it happens to a lot of people. They get to be age 45 or 50, and they're no longer as rebellious. They're no longer as imaginative. They're no longer the Young Turk, and instead he's resisting the Young Turks who are leading his own theory, quantum theory, to become a quantum mechanics that's based on uncertainties and probabilities. And Einstein just doesn't believe that's true. Spends years futilely trying to get a unified field theory that'll reconcile quantum mechanics with relativity. People wonder, why have you become such a defender of the old order when you were once such an imaginative rebel? And he said, "To punish me for my contempt for authority, God made me into an authority myself." And so he said that calcified his thinking. Even on his deathbed, he's sort of dealing with the three things that matter most to him. His aneurysm is burst. He's hemorrhaging. He knows he's going to die, but he was been asked to give a speech for the Israeli Independence Day, but he had told Ben-Gurion, "I'm not going to talk about Israel. I want to talk about the need for world peace in the atomic age and for nations to work together." So he writes the first sentence of that speech, which is, "I speak to you today not only as a Jew and not only as an American citizen, but as a human being." Then the pain becomes great, and he puts the speech aside. But a few moments later, he reaches to his bedside table again. He's got a page of equations. After 22 years, he's still working on all those equations, trying to get him that unified field theory. And you can see tightly lined pages, carefully written meticulously, still making a few math mistakes, crossing them out, correcting the math, until finally he writes one last line of equations that dribble off as he goes to sleep for the last time. One last line of equations that he thought might get him and the rest of us closer to what he called the spirit manifest in the laws of the universe. So that's how an impertinent and rebellious but incredibly imaginative and creative third-class patent clerk became the mind reader of the creator of the cosmos and the locksmith of the mysteries of the atom and the universe. Thank you.
Walter Isaacson, author of Einstein, His Life and Universe. Isaacson spoke recently at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley in a program sponsored by the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his speech, Walter Isaacson took some questions from the audience in a session moderated by Charles Garvin, a Harvard classmate of Isaacson's and a fellow Rhodes Scholar. Garvin is currently a partner at the merchant banking firm Palisades Associates.
Let's start, at the beginning. You've penned now lengthy biographies of Henry Kissinger, Ben Franklin, now Albert Einstein. And in particular, between Franklin and Einstein, do those two figures strike you as having anything or very much in common?
I like to write about people's minds and how minds work. You know, some biographers like to write about, you know, military heroes or sports heroes or people of great character, like Washington or something. To me, the most interesting thing is what makes a mind work. And as I said at the beginning of the lecture, I've had a long career in journalism, just as you would have had in a career in Silicon Valley. You know, it's not just intelligence that makes somebody significant or successful. So you say, what are the added ingredients? With Ben Franklin, I tried to take the added ingredient of wisdom, that common sense and that ability to find the common ground after hearing everybody out and bring people together in sort of a wise and judicious way. I did it partly because every time you write a book, you're trying. You know, when I grew up in Louisiana, my grandfather said to me, there are two types of people that come out of Louisiana, preachers and storytellers. And he said, for God's sake, be a storyteller. So what you do is you try to tell through stories a particular lesson. That's Henry Luce taught us at Time magazine. And the lesson then to me was that we had become a nation in which we were very polarized and very ideological, and we were forgetting that we shared a huge set of common values, and that if we look for those common values, we could work together the way Benjamin Franklin was able to do at the Declaration of Independence, Constitutional Convention, and all. With Einstein, he's not somebody distinguished by common sense or whatever. He's distinguished by creativity and imagination. And so even though they were both smart, I'm not sure that Ben Franklin was the smartest guy amongst the founders. I mean, you have Madison and Jefferson, a lot of people. And believe it or not, you had people at Einstein's time who in a conventional way were more knowledgeable, whether it be Max Planck or Henri Poincaré or Lorentz and others. But I do believe that we are trying to compete in the 21st century. And we're trying to compete, and this doesn't apply to you because you're here in Silicon Valley where there's an appreciation for science and technology, but in most places we're trying to compete by saying our kids have got to learn science, but many people treat science as something intimidating, something nerdy, something they don't do. Oh, I can't do science. I don't like math, you know. But they think they like Shakespeare or something. And so I'll say to them, yeah, do you love Hamlet? And they say, yeah, I love Hamlet. I say, really, do you think Hamlet loves Ophelia? And they go, I don't know, I don't understand that. And why does he kill Polonius? Well, I'm not sure. But you can appreciate Hamlet or brag about appreciating Hamlet even if you don't know every bit of it or the underlying reasons behind it. Likewise, I feel we should look at math and science as being creative, as parents, as my generation, even those of us not in science, even if we're not going to understand the underpinnings of general relativity, just as we don't understand the underpinnings of Hamlet, we shouldn't go around bragging, gee, I'll never understand science, just as we would never go around bragging, I'll never understand Shakespeare. We should all try to appreciate the creativity and imagination of a Shakespeare and the creativity and the imagination of an Einstein if we're going to succeed in this century and to make science something more than something we're trying to force feed our kids by rote so they'll beat people from China or something.
Yep. You know, taking off from that for a second, the historians of science sometimes deplore the relative waste, it's Einstein, so it's all relative, of the last 30 years of his life when he seemed to have left what you were just describing, his methodology with the strong role of imagination, metaphor, as you put it, marveling at ordinary things, and instead he seemed lost in obscure mathematical formalism, and that part of his life, you know, certainly wasn't nearly so productive. What happened?
Well, as I said, one of the things you have to worry about when you celebrate creativity is what happens when, as Einstein put it, we become old, we become calcified, we become famous, and thus we become more blockheaded. And indeed, that's what he said in German, blockheaded. So that's part of the cautionary tale is it inevitable that when you get older, you get less creative and less imaginative and less rebellious? And secondly, it comes to what you said, a more subtle and complex issue, which is having rejected the need for mathematics when he was an impertinent student, when he does his theory of general relativity, he approaches it in two different ways. It's complex, and I try to do it in the book simply, but it's still, he takes a physical strategy in which he looks at the physics and tries to figure out how it worked. But he also, in parallel, in his notebooks in Zurich, the Zurich notebooks, does a mathematical strategy where he's simply trying to get equations that are generally covariant so that they deal with accelerated motion as well as they deal with constant velocity motion. And the pure mathematical approach, which Hilbert, the mathematician competing against him in Göttingen, is doing, because he's a better mathematician, Hilbert is, and he also has the advantage of being a worse physicist in that he doesn't know physics. All he's going is for the mathematical formalism. It turns out that the mathematical approach ends up being what's successful for Einstein, using something called the Riemann tensors and Ricci tensor and others, which are just, you know, mathematical units that describe the curvature of space or multidimensional space at various points of the universe. So he does it in a very mathematical way, and then he becomes a little too enamored, critics would say, of the mathematical approach as he tries to get a unified theory, not by having some underlying physical insight. Once again, he doesn't have that imaginative thought experiment that describes the physics of a unified theory to him. No rising elevators or falling apples or right. rolling balls on a trampoline. He's doing it only through mathematical formalism, and he fails.
Yep.
Now, he will look less bad if Brian Greene or Brian Greene's grandson or somebody using mathematical formalism involving multiple dimensions ends up with a superstring theory that has not only the mathematical elegance that string theory now has, but also has some bearing and basis in reality, which string theory doesn't have at the moment. But if it turns out that string theory is correct, Einstein will look less silly in his latter years because he was doing something quite similar, which is using multiple dimensions in a mathematical way to try to find an elegant mathematical formulation of a unified field.
Well, he was, and one wonders, since superstring theory and its many variations for the first time have promise of realizing the dream, the unified field theory, do you think if he were alive today he would be working in that paradigm?
For better or worse, yes. And I don't know if I mean that as a... I mean, you know, every now and then you hear the great debates. I heard one recently between Lawrence Krauss and Brian Greene of whether string theory is just a total concoction that bears no connection to reality, or whether it is the culmination of Einstein's dream. It's always hard to say what would Einstein be doing now. This is a little bit easier than the question I got yesterday on talk radio, which is when the disc jockey came on and said, we're going to now talk about Einstein, who was the smartest person on Earth, and I've been wanting to ask a question for a long time. What would Einstein have thought about IMUS? So... I know a little bit more about what Einstein would have thought about Brian Greene, which is they're doing similar things, which is using mathematics to try to get a unified theory. And I think Einstein would be in that camp, because that's the way he died, in that camp.
Right. One thing you do comment on, both in the book and in your remarks today, is Einstein's strong belief in God and his spiritual leanings. Do you think that helped him or hurt him? Did it limit the breadth of his thinking as physics moved toward a probabilistic universe?
You know, people thought when he said, in his opposition to quantum mechanics, for example, the uncertainties and probabilities and chance at the core of quantum mechanics, he repeatedly said, I cannot believe that God would play dice with the universe. At one point in the Solvay Conference of 1927, Niels Bohr stands up and says, Einstein, please quit telling God what to do. It's always a person who told people to turn off their cell phones who has a cell phone on. Thank you, Trish. People thought that he was using a figure of speech. And they were surprised when repeatedly and often at dinners, personally, privately, in letters, and in the public articles, he would say, no, it's not a figure of speech. I believe in God. And I ask myself, when I'm looking at a theory, is this the way God would have created the universe? And that, to me, helps guide my path. So the answer to your question is he felt it was helpful. He believed there was an elegance, and he called it, when asked about it, he said, there's a spirit manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit in the face of which we must be humbled and awed. And to me, that spirit is my intimation of God. Now, it was not a personal intercessional God, not somebody you could pray to say, help make traffic better so I can get to work on time or something. And he said, you know, some people think miracles are evidence of God's existence. For me, it's the lack of miracles that's evidence of God's existence, that there's a harmony in all of God's laws. This didn't satisfy many people, because they said, okay, well, I don't get it. In fact, there was a cardinal in Boston who gives a sermon saying it still smacks of atheism because it's not a personal God who intercedes on your behalf. So Rabbi Morris Goldstein, the head of the Reform movement in New York at the time in the late 1930s, sends him a telegram saying, Einstein, do you or do you not believe in God? Answer 50 words or less. And Einstein doesn't use up all 50 words. He just says, I believe in Spinoza's God, a God whose spirit is manifest in the harmonies of the universe.
Walter Isaacson, speaking about his new book, Einstein, His Life and Universe, at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley. You're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media.
You focused in the book and again today on the role of not only knowledge, but also intuition, imagination in forging the great ideas as Einstein did. Is there something that we could or should be doing in our educational system to foster that among our youth?
Yeah, I'm not an educational expert, although at the Aspen Institute, we were approached by a lot of people on the No Child Left Behind bill, which gets to what you're saying, which is standards and, you know, whatever,
yep.
Testing. And the No Child Left Behind bill had become enormously politicized. It became an ideological, you know, touchstone where people could just say No Child Left Behind and there'd be cheers and boos and stuff. And for somebody like myself, I assume that there's probably some good stuff in No Child Left Behind, including the need for standards, the need for good tests, the need for standardized national tests even. And there was some bad stuff in No Child Left Behind. And that our political system no longer worked particularly well to say, since it has to be either reauthorized, amended, or thrown out this year, because it expires this year, our political system was not particularly geared to saying, let's find the good, let's throw out the bad, let's do some modifications, and let's take it out of heated politics and make it into just common sense, what works, what doesn't. So Margaret Spellings of the Department of Education called me, and then the Ford Foundation called me, and then the Gates Foundation, saying, can you help figure out No Child Left Behind? And we appointed a group to figure out what was right and wrong with the bill. And they came up with an entire plan to do No Child that would encourage creativity, imagination, and different ways of thinking, but still allow standards and testing so we know where we were getting.
Yep.
And I think it will form the basis for the reauthorization. I say that long thing not just to give a plug for the Aspen Institute, what it does, but because when you look at an Einstein, you realize we have to nurture different ways of thinking and different forms of creativity, but that doesn't mean we should just let standards go and have no way of measuring how well we're educating our kids. If it were an easy topic, you know, I try to do it through the book, which is remember, people think imaginatively in different ways.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean that, and it means we should be wary of pure rote learning or teaching math the way we do now, which is just hammering in mathematical laws and equations as opposed to having people visualize and picture math. But, you know, it's an important topic.
Absolutely. Well, Walter Isaacson, let's return to the topic of this book, Einstein, for a moment. And we did have a couple of other questions I thought were interesting that were pointed up by a couple of the anecdotes that you amusingly spin. One, which you touched on in your remarks today, was Einstein's first marriage. As you pointed out, it was to a fellow physicist. You know, I have to throw in that I loved your quoting his letter to her after a time when they were apart. I can already imagine the fun we'll have, and then we'll start in on Helmholtz's electromagnetic theory of light.
Right.
Must have been a great relationship. Anyway, it turned stormy, and He divorced that wife, but there's been a controversy since as to whether she deserves more credit than he gave her for his theories.
There's a wonderful controversy, which I, of course, geek out on totally in the book, on how much credit Mileva deserves for the special theory of relativity. There are a couple of letters in which he refers to it as our theory. And it becomes, like a lot of controversies, not just a scientific one, but it goes into emotional and feminist and other things. There are all sorts of conferences that he stole the thing from Mileva. I go into it quite a bit, and I conclude that it wasn't really her theory. She helped check the math. She helped him as a sounding board. And I do this, I hope, in all honesty, because obviously it would make for a better book if it had been her theory and he took it. And it's not like I'm shying away from that. But now that we have all of the papers and all of the notebooks and all of the letters they wrote to each other day by day, you can discover that the main step that I described to you, the relativity of simultaneity, is something he does walking with Michele Besso. You can discover what he does the next day, what he writes and stuff. So, and none of the underlying concepts of special relativity are from Mileva. But she helps with the manuscript once he's written it and helps correct some of the math. I do not think that you should or have to exaggerate her accomplishments in order to do her justice and show her respect as somebody who is a great pioneer as a woman physicist trying to overcome the obstacles at the time. So I don't think the people who are claiming more for her than the evidence warrants are really doing her justice. Yep. I think we should respect her for the amazing woman she was and not try to hype what she did.
Understand. You know, your own treatment of Einstein in the several, you know, very favorable reviews of the book that have come out so far, they've called you affectionate in your handling of him, but in fact, he comes across in the book as, to use your words, detached and aloof to many of those close to him. He was capable of extramarital dalliances. He was very stubborn, and at times he was cruel to his wife and to his kids. On balance, is this a guy that you'd like to be friends with?
Well, you know, he gets better as he gets older, even though he gets to be less good of a scientist, and there may be a correlation between those two trends. He makes up with his first wife. He reconciles with Mileva. His oldest son moves to America with him, you know, and he becomes a more genial guy. Whether it's, you know, my wife worries that between, you know, Henry Kissinger, Ben Franklin, and Albert Einstein, I keep picking people who are really mean to their first wife. I tell her it was coincidence. And then people say, how could you like somebody who, you know, was cold to the first wife, was somewhat mean to the children? Somebody in Aspen asked me that. And I was looking at this guy, and you probably even know this guy's name, so I won't say it. And he's like on his fifth trophy wife. He probably can't remember the birthdays of his kids. And yeah, and so I said to him, yeah, you ever know anybody like that? I mean, one of the things you discover is these people are human, and they have flaws. And they, yes, I'm affectionate, but I think a normal human being can be affectionate and admiring of somebody, even if that person has flaws and is made of flesh and blood. In fact, I find people more interesting when I discover that Benjamin Franklin is not actually made of marble on a pedestal, but he's actually has flesh and blood traits and passions, and same with Einstein.
Is there anybody else? You've obviously had occasion now to look over biographical material for a number of physicists, and I'm tempted to ask, has any other physicist, or for that matter, any other thinker, shown the ability that you highlight time and time again to develop profound insights from homely metaphor and visual imagery?
No, I mean, there's no great physicist anywhere near that now. I do think Stephen Hawking has done a great job of both imagining and then proving the ultimate in Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the existence of black holes.
Sure.
I think that the people here in Silicon Valley, and I used this last night in Boston in a talk, I said I was coming here, they're the people most likely to think different, to use one of the phrases that Steve Jobs used in a great advertising campaign that starts with the iconic picture of Einstein saying, think different with the apple. And Steve Jobs is obviously in that category of somebody who can think differently, although I guess the grammar is better to say think differently, stuff. So I think you'll see it in a variety of fields. But at the moment, that's why I picked Einstein. He's so far and above anybody else as a way of looking at creative minds.
No doubt. In fact, if you were today to nominate, to reference your earlier comments about what happened back at time, a person of the century or, you know, let's even up the ante and say a person of the millennium, who would you put in that category?
Well, I mean, obviously the person of the century for the 20th century is clearly to me Albert Einstein. You know, if you wanted to talk about the millennium, I might pick Gutenberg, because I do think that the, and this is a very technologically savvy place, that the invention of movable type, at least in Europe, allows the growth of ideas to travel from place to place, and thus the Renaissance, and allows people access to their own Bibles, and thus the Reformation. And when you see how technology can change things, and this is just a great technology. I actually believe print is a very good technology, which will survive another 400 years. It's a great technology for the storage, transmission, and retrieval of information and ideas, meaning print on paper. So I think that was the great technology that still will be a great technology. I'm often interested in how Newton's scientific ideas help lead to the Enlightenment, how both technology and scientific ideas lead to the Renaissance. And here with Einstein, you do have somebody whose scientific and technical and philosophical ideas lead to the birth of modernism.
You bet.
I mean, obviously, I'm showing my prejudice by picking a technologist or scientist, meaning a Gutenberg, Newton, or Einstein. But I'll end with the note of Einstein, when asked about that, why he didn't accept the presidency of Israel while he was still working on unified field theory, he says, politics is for the moment, an equation is for eternity. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Walter Isaacson's new book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. Isaacson is the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, and he spoke April 25th at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley. His talk was sponsored by the Commonwealth Club of California. If you missed part of today's speech by Walter Isaacson, or if you would just like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting our website, wordforword.org. There, you may also subscribe to our weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including sessions with John Kerry, Newt Gingrich, Hillary Clinton, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Kyle Sisko.
American Public Media.